It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Last week, Transparency International revealed a discouraging trend in its annual U.S. corruption barometer. The watchdog group noted that Americans are growing more cynical regarding corruption and are expressing greater concern about wrongdoing within the U.S. government. A just-released book by a pair of Illinois State University professors takes a fresh look at the ongoing problem of corruption and its impact from the ground up. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
The dark underbelly of corruption is exposed as two Illinois State University professors have teamed up to edit a book that's as timely as it is enlightening. Nancy Lind from Politics and Government and Kara Raby Hemp from Criminal Justice have produced Corruption, Accountability and Discretion, which reaches across disciplines into research on corruption, exploring gerrymandering, vote buying, sexual harassment, and more, in order to explore how corruption impacts public policymakers and the average citizen, who Nancy Lind says recoils from the corrosive touch of corruption.
Well, we were finding that a lot of citizens were stopping coming to the polls, not voting, having a lot of criticisms about Congress and the presidency because they felt like whatever they did didn't matter because the politicians were all so corrupt that they had their votes bought, for example, before the election, and citizens just kind of felt left out of the picture. So we wanted to delve into when this corruption first started and the kind of impacts it's had on public policymaking.
So when did this start?
I think corruption has been around as long as government. Anytime individuals or people influence it, there's corruption in influence. And so it's really interesting to think about how discretion of individual decision makers then leads to this idea of corruption. And then how do we increase accountability?
Well, where does the impulse to be corrupt actually come from? Is that something innate in some people, or does being in a particular system naturally bring that about? Nancy, can you talk about that?
I mean, I guess I think that individuals, the more power they have and the more discretion that they are granted, the greater the likelihood to sometimes accidentally abuse that power.
What do you mean accidentally?
Overstepping their boundaries without necessarily knowing that, and then realizing, wait a minute, I got away with that. Perhaps it's something I can continue doing, and then becoming more conscious about engaging in probably not illegal actions, but certainly what most of us would call unethical actions.
What exactly does corruption do to our government? Is it wholly corrosive?
Mm-hmm. I would say it does have a corrosive impact, not only on public policy and the policies that are passed that impact the lives of everyday citizens, but also political stability and the influence that citizens can have on our governmental system. And finally, in our democratic institutions, where people typically go to participate in government, all of those institutions have seen the corrosive impact of corruption.
And I think it also leaves citizens much more cynical. People who might be willing to run for office see the degrees of corruption in the legislative, executive, or even judicial branches, and they think, well, if it's all going to be corrupt, I'm not going to be able to make a difference if I go there, so I'm going to instead move into the nonprofit sector and try to work around the government instead of through the government.
So cynicism leads to people feeling disenfranchised.
Another aspect of that is it also undermines the effectiveness of our political system. So the ability for us to get the work done that needs to be done in our political system is undermined through corruption. One of the chapters looks at wars, right, and how we finance wars. So from that to public policy such as crime, we see that it undermines the effectiveness of our ability as a government to get the work done that we need to do.
All right, but is it possible that corruption actually is necessary in order to get some things done? And I'm going to reach back into the 19th century and mention Tammany Hall, which actually focused on helping poor people, particularly immigrants, particularly Irish immigrants especially. Is corruption actually necessary in order to help?
I don't think Tammany Hall is the degree of corruption we saw today. With Tammany Hall, it was much more just leakage of information where, you know, the slogan was, I've seen my opportunities and I took them. So basically they had some forward-looking information on which land might be available. They found that out through probably what we'd use as social media today, but through the grapevine. Back in the 19th century, And when they had a reason to believe that government might pay a higher price for a piece of land, and they owned that land, or they could purchase the land and make a profit on it, politicians were willing to do so. Now we see much more outright graft that's occurring, where literally one of the chapters talks about vote buying. You provide enough money for my campaign, and when one of your interests comes before the floor of the House or the Senate, I pretty much will guarantee that that policy will be passed.
Okay, Nancy, you just mentioned social media. Is this a good way to help keep corruption in check? Oh, you're nodding, Cara.
Yeah, because what's interesting is that historically we've used things like strict regulation, we've used oversight to sort of keep corruption in check, but it's clear that those things are not working, right? So I think modern methods of accountability are media, social media, citizen protest. These are increasingly becoming more modern mechanisms of accountability.
Let's talk about traditional media now. How does the media feed into corruption themes and narratives, and looking especially at our most recent election in 2016. Kara? Mm-hmm.
Well, specific to criminal justice, we have several examples in that when we talk about the media sort of primes and frames what gets play in the criminal justice policy. And with the perspective of sort of if it bleeds, it leads, we see a lot of violence focus, despite the fact that nationally crime has been down, right? So what that does is it presents crime as a problem that needs a solution. And so you saw in the most recent election a variety of different solutions to crime problems. But before there was this perspective of really highlighting violence in the media, we didn't see Americans as afraid. We didn't see Americans perceiving crime as a social problem. Now it really is one of the top couple of social problems that Americans report every year in polls. And so the media has sort of single-handedly, with a relationship between politicians, raised this fear of crime among Americans, when in actuality, what we know is that crime is down in most places in the United States right now.
And I don't think the media certainly is to blame. One of the arguments that's made is that they sensationalize the corrupt events because that's how you get readership. But I think these days the corruption actually exceeds the sensationalization of what might have been past media stories.
Another way of holding accountable is just this relationship between the media and experts in the area. So today we're here talking about our book and we're able to discuss the reality of what's happening in politics and government, the reality of what's happening of what we know in criminal justice research. But if you look at nationally, rarely are social science experts asked to comment on things that are happening within the social sciences like politics and crime. So just building stronger relationships between researchers and the media is a great way to sort of build the knowledge information so then that information is disseminated to the American people when they listen to the radio and watch television.
Okay, Kara, Nancy, who out there has the power to instigate accountability? Who holds that power? Is it the courts? Is it the government? Is it the people?
I really think it's the people. I think it's citizens who have to hold all the branches of government and the media accountable for their actions, whether that's through unconventional interest articulation or actual outright protest movements. It could be something as simple as a letter writing campaign, could be a face-to-face meeting, but it's keeping the stories out there so that they don't disappear when President Trump starts the next media event of corruption.
Kara?
I think all of those bodies that you talked about have a role to play in establishing, you know, strict oversight and control. And according to several of the chapters in our book, the courts play a role, people play a role. But increasingly, we're seeing this focus of a sort of social protest on the behalf of citizens. And so we are seeing a younger group of Americans that are involved in politics in ways that we haven't over the last decade. To me, that is really exciting about what that means for accountability of our elected officials and also our public officials.
We're hearing a lot of conversations right now about corruption. It seems to be a very powerful theme, not just politically speaking, but the sexual harassment theme is very, very strong right now. Is this something that is going to continue? Do we have to make sure that it continues so we can start applying some accountability as well? Where do you see this whole arc going?
I personally think it has to stay in the media because right now, in my opinion, I think in a lot of ways, with the kind of statements that President Trump has been making, we've moved backwards as a country. And laws that were created in the 70s, 80s, 90s to protect minority groups and women have pretty much been put on the back burner because it seems like our chief executive officer believes certain kind of actions that for decades we thought were inappropriate are now considered appropriate. And so unless we keep those in the media, people are going to start thinking, oh, well, that's the norm. We can go ahead and harass women all we want because, well, the president did it. He grabbed somebody by the behind, and it's okay to do now. And I think we don't want to move backwards as a country and accept those kind of norms.
You know, I agree with Nancy. I think that what we're seeing is sort of a backlash to progress that was made, specifically when we look at sexual harassment and the rights of women and equality in the workplace. You know, what's very apparent, the take-home message to me in watching what's happening over the last couple of weeks, is just how ineffective the policies and the laws that we passed in the 1990s and the 2000s, when we thought we were in a post sexual harassment society, it's clear that that is not true and that actually women are experiencing these things in the workplace every day and that more strict oversight is needed. But I agree with Nancy that until this becomes an issue that people are talking about on a daily basis, until this doesn't become one person's experience, but a lived experience of women. And I think there are some sort of social media attempts being made to sort of let this embody the experiences of women nationwide and not simply, you know, in particular occupations or areas. Until that happens, we probably won't see the response in policy and laws that we need.
And I think a lot of that goes back to the exercise of discretion. That laws are intentionally written vaguely and ambiguously, so there's lots of room for interpretation. And when we've had a change in political parties and a change in the political environment right now, people are looking for those loopholes of discretion to allow certain things to occur that we, for the last 50 years, thought had gone away or at least been buried in the books.
That's Illinois State University professors Nancy Lind and Kara Raby Hemp. Their book is Corruption, Accountability, and Discretion. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Lind and Hemp are currently at work on a follow-up book on social protest and its growing place as an agent of change. You're listening to Sound Ideas.